This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host Jessica Thomas speaks with local author Richard Lawrence Miller about his book, Drug Warriors and Their Prey, From Police Power to Police State, and The House I Live In, the documentary film his book inspired. Later in the show, we will talk with Mike Farrell, B.J. Honeycutt of the TV show MASH, about how he became a death penalty abolitionist and a benefit he is doing for Missourians for alternatives to the death penalty. Now, let's go to Jessica and Richard.
Good morning, Jeff, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Jaws of Justice this morning. With me in the studio, our guest, Richard Miller. And Richard, you are a Lincoln Scholar.
That's correct.
And how does one become a Lincoln Scholar, just to set things up for our listeners?
How does one become a Lincoln Scholar? Well, the first thing is to be interested in Lincoln, which I've been interested in ever since I was a small kid, even before I started going to school. I just thought Lincoln was a terrific person for some reason. And over the years, as I grew up and became actually a serious scholar and historian and studied Lincoln, I discovered that he was the real thing. Too many people you look into and it turns out, well, they were fake in some way. But Lincoln was the real McCoy. He really did wonderful things for the country. And the more I study him, the more respect I have for him.
There's a lot of parallels going with Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, which he's very well known for. I mean, I don't want to have to give everybody a history lesson on Lincoln here this morning, but it is very relevant to your area of study, which eventually led you into the laws, the drug laws, and the drug war that's going on. There's quite a parallel there with what he is, because I, and myself, it's not just myself, but of course, you could see the obvious, the new plantation, the prison, or, you know, from school to prison, kind of a pipeline that's going on here, or even a somewhat of a, I don't want to say genocide, but it's because it's not a genocide, the drugs, but it's like a removal of a people. If we can't enslave them because slavery is illegal, but we can't, there's other ways to reduce that population and from freedom and removing rights. A lot of those go along with your studies of Lincoln.
Lincoln, by the way, the Americans of his era were concerned about drug abuse. We've kind of forgotten that.
Yes.
Society back then was quite well aware of marijuana and opium, but the thing they were most worried about was beverage alcohol. And one of the things that Lincoln took, his approach differed from the traditional attitude back then, in that he felt that people who had a drinking problem were not evil. There was a tendency to portray them as bad people, morally. But Lincoln felt they were ordinary people and that they needed support from the community. And he organized groups to provide support for drinking problems. He there was a group called the Washingtonian Society that he helped with. And his attitude was, if drinking is a problem for the country, then we all have to be part of the solution. We can't just concentrate on people who have a drinking problem. It's wider than that, which was a very forward type thinking, even today.
Yes, where we're looking at these people as being criminals and not with having a health issue, which is what kind of boils down to.
Yeah.
I noticed a real interesting thing is that the largest mental health care provider in the world is the L.A. County Jail.
Which is kind of a chilling thought. Very few regional jails can provide the quality of care that a regional hospital can provide.
Right. And they're just not diagnosed until they're incarcerated.
Right.
And all those issues that come up. So this, your journey brought you along into researching the drug war and statistics.
Right. Golly, as we all know, the drug war is such a complex and complicated thing. I view it as mainly a war on ordinary people and a war on democracy. I think that authoritarians have been using the drug situation as an excuse to eliminate one civil liberty after another, which is a big deal because they try to provide or portray civil liberties as things that only criminals want. Mm-hmm. Like if they have a random stoppage of traffic doing inspections of cars, and you protest and say, what's the probable cause here? They say, well, why would you protest searching your car if you haven't done anything wrong? Well, the whole point of these civil liberties isn't to protect bad people. It's to protect good people.
Exactly.
And every one of these civil liberties we lose makes it that much easier for authoritarians to rule our lives. So we got to be strict about standing up for these things.
When you first published your book, Drug War Warriors, mm-hmm. and Their Prey, and which was a police, I want to say police state, how are you going to put it?
Oh, from police power to police state.
Police power to police state, right. Mm-hmm. In 1997.
Right.
What do you see that there's been changes? Because I know, like, the last figures were, or data that I saw was released in 2007. They really don't have a whole new set of statistics mm-hmm. that have come out, and so much changes in a year, let alone to have these statistics out.
Well, first of all, you have to recognize that all these numbers are soft. Mm-hmm. They can be massaged around. Certainly up until recent years, drug usage had been going down. It's something that most people aren't all that interested in, contrary to what the drug war propaganda would have you think.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, I've seen where some drug usage is going up. But, of course, the question is that necessarily a bad thing? Can drugs be used both a lot and responsibly? That sort of issue hasn't been investigated too much. We just look at these simple numbers and see drug use is going up. That equals that's bad. Maybe it's irrelevant. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book was maybe a loose script for the film that just came out, The House I Live In.
Yes.
And when did the director contact you about?
The director, Eugene Jarecki, contacted me in the early part of 2009 and said he had read through the book and thought it could be a good framework for a movie he'd like to do about the drug war. And he came out to Kansas City to my house, spent the day turning the house into a movie studio, and mm-hmm. interviewed me all day long. And let me tell you, even if you're familiar with the topic, if you start talking about it at 9 o'clock in the morning and you're done about 8 o'clock at night, you're pretty worn out.
But it really affects us all, mm-hmm. this topic of, first of all, it's a drug war, and it's, as that title does implicate, it is a war. And it's a war that's being raged and held on American soil, on American people.
Yes.
And and it affects us all. Because, you may not realize it, but are your neighbors, or it filters through. The children are affected. Families are torn apart. And I think that was kind of the message of the film, which was released, came out on the 11th here mm-hmm. at the Tivoli. And kind of, you know, what I noticed about the film was that, you know, it really showed us how much of our culture is built around it. Whole towns are prison towns because people are employees or families of the incarcerated, but most likely employees and people that depend on the prison system for their livelihood. So and this for-profit thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's sort of a bureaucratic thrust going on where more and more people get to have a stake in keeping the drug war going the way it is. And for that reason, it gets harder and harder to slow anything down because the advocates of making the war harsher are all making money from it, or they're getting something else from it. It isn't strictly altruistic. And people who are skeptical about the war have a harder and harder time doing anything about it because the advocates of the war have so many institutions behind them. And the skeptics don't have any institutions behind them.
Right. And I noticed that, lately there are several organizations that have been formed, like Americans for Forfeiture Control mm-hmm. or Asset Seizure and Forfeiture Control. We're looking at when a drug bust happens, the money is confiscated, and then that money is divided between certain agencies, including prosecuting attorneys' offices, the police station, the police themselves, and then other agencies. So everybody gets a slice of whatever is confiscated. Generally, they confiscate that up front, and then you're forced to prove that you're innocent and those are not ill-gotten gains.
Yes, I think civil forfeiture is a good example of how the drug war is affecting ordinary people. We tend to think the people who get caught up in the drug war are somehow involved in drug deals or whatever. But you can be perfectly blameless and have a lot of property taken away from you. For instance, it's possible if, say, you're a landlord and one of your tenants in an apartment building smokes marijuana, your entire apartment building can be confiscated as a drug asset, even though you didn't know anything about what was going on. And I think it's important for people to realize that you can have no involvement whatsoever in the drug war and still be swept up by it with things like the civil forfeiture. And the civil forfeiture is also bad because it makes the drug war a profitable thing for law enforcement agencies. So what they do is they enforce the drug laws and ignore other kinds of laws. And a lot of things going on in our communities where we want the police to help, but they just don't have the resources or the interest anymore because all the money is in the drug war. That's how they keep. That's how some departments fund their operations.
And I noticed that they also said, of course, they're looking at your numbers. So detectives on the narcotics squad are turning in slips. You know, they've had 30 arrests in 15 days, and they look really like they're really doing something. And then you've got homicide that maybe has an arrest. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, in the detectives, it has maybe two arrests that month. And so they're looking to promote, and they're promoting people coming up out of, you know, with these great arrest records that are for, I mean, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I think it's 50% of Americans are using, like, cannabis, mm-hmm. which is illegal. And so if you get caught in it, they find it in your car, they can take your car. You have money in your pocket. You may be on your way to pay a down payment on something or make a deposit, and they take your money. So for that, at that moment, you know, this, it's a lot more. There's a lot more incentive to bust a user of drugs. So then you've got someone with a lot of great arrest records that are getting promoted within the department for great performance, but it may not be, you know, as qualified of an individual, that a detective that's in another age area of the police department that deserves, you know, that has more talent in a detective. So it looks like it's promoting within or promoting on a good record of arrests.
In terms of sheer numbers, one of the easiest things to do is to do drug busts because the narcotics squads facilitate the crimes. Almost always the indictments are going to say that somebody sold something to an undercover agent mm-hmm. or they bought something from an undercover agent. So the drug squads themselves are facilitating these crimes. Now, you don't see the arson squad going around setting fires to solve cases.
Right.
You don't see homicide squads going around arranging murders. But the drug squads arrange the crimes that they arrest people for. And so that's sort of unique in law enforcement, and it should be sort of a little alarm bell for people to ask, why is this happening? What strange thing is going on here?
And it seems to be a system that's motivated primarily by financial gain and those numbers. And everybody is motivated to get in it because we get our percentage of it.
Right.
Our percentages out of it.
Right.
And we look at, it's 9:15. I wanted to let our listeners know that they're listening to the Jaws of Justice here on KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City. And with me is Richard Miller. And Richard is a Lincoln scholar, also author of the book Drug Warriors and Their Prey. And we're discussing some of the aspects of this drug war and that led Richard's book into being a framework for the film that's just released at the in this area is showing now at the TIVL called The House I Live In.
Now, I think it's good to mention that film a couple times because it's a very incisive look at the drug war, and I think it's very good for people to see who are interested in what might be going on but they don't have a whole lot of knowledge. The film won the Sundance Film Festival Award for Best Documentary of the Year, so it's been receiving acclaim in places where it's seen. And you've seen the movie yourself.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. So you know the kind of effort that Jaraki put into finding people around the country to talk to, and the stories they told, and even just the landscapes he's showing, it helps you appreciate the size of the problem that he's discussing.
And it really does concern us all.
Absolutely, no question about it. One of the things that happens with the drug war is that it involves what's called status crime. In other words, people are being punished for what they are instead of what they do. At first, a lot of the drug wars or drug laws were passed to get around that sort of thing. There's a lot of racial prejudice involved, and as I point out in the movie, in part of my presentation, back in the 100 years ago, for example, out in California, people hated the Chinese, or whites hated the Chinese. But you couldn't arrest people just for the status of being Chinese. Mm-hmm. So they found something to charge them with that is associated with being Chinese, which was smoking opium. And so they're arresting people for smoking opium and getting them out of the job market and making these jobs more available for whites. And the same thing happened with other drugs going on and other races. And I think, though we have a tendency to say, okay, that's the sort of status thing, you're being harassed because of what you are, that still involves other people, not me. But an example where that sort of thing happens to ordinary people today is, say, high school students. A lot of times in high schools, there's a general search of lockers and people's property and their pants and whatever to see if they have any drugs with them. But that, without probable cause, that's all illegal. Except the courts have ruled that if you have the status of being a high school student, just because you're a high school student, that makes you a drug suspect. Hmm. And so suddenly the Fourth Amendment no longer applies to high school students. And we're teaching high school students, therefore, that civil liberties don't apply when it comes to drug issues. And we're also teaching them that because police say that if you're upset, that's because you're guilty. We're teaching them that civil liberties are a bad thing, that they're something that criminals depend on, that protect criminals instead of protecting the rest of us from being harassed for no reason at all. The right against search and seizure was regarded as one of the key rights in the Nuremberg trials of war criminals after World War II. This isn't just a little side thing. Well, it's nice if you're walking down the street not to be stopped by a cop
right.
for no reason.
Mm-hmm. And I know the ACLU is addressing that very issue of people being pulled over, I mean, not pulled over, stopped mm-hmm. while walking as a pedestrian because you fit what could be a profile of someone
right.
that could possibly be doing something wrong. Then they are caught with something on them, just a small amount of marijuana or whatever it is they have on. There was no reason for to stop them for peacefully walking.
Right. And a lot of times with these searches, and in fact, in the majority of times, these searches come up with nothing because people were just minding their own business, driving around, riding around. They're, say, a bus passenger, and they pull over into town for the lunch break. And the cops decide to search everyone on the bus because there might be somebody there who is violating some drug law. Well, why should you have to have all your stuff ransacked? This is done with cars, too. Typically, police will say, well, we need to search your car. And people don't realize you can just say no to that.
Exactly.
And people don't realize also that a search involves more than, like, looking in the glove compartment. If the cops want to, they can take your car apart. And maybe they'll put it back together, or maybe they won't.
Or they can just take it.
They can take it through civil forfeiture. That's true.
Right.
You know, we tend to think these civil forfeiture things, the authorities are finding some sort of money involved with drugs. That isn't necessarily the case. Say you're a merchant, say a gem merchant going to gem shows. Well, there's a lot of cash transactions involved in these things. And so if you have, say, $5,000 cash on you and you're stopped and asked to account for this money and you can't immediately, then that money is seized by the law enforcement authorities. And it's not automatically given back. You have to jump through a whole bunch of hoops.
A lot of hopes to prove that it belonged to you, that you got it without, I mean, how you got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Richard, we could talk about this, and we're not even getting to the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole,
right.
there's a whole Titanic mm-hmm. beneath that iceberg, because we've only touched on just the civil liberties of search and seizure, asset seizure, loss of freedom, and we you're not even looking at the sentencing and the mandatory minimums, which get a lot of people sucked into the justice system. And I know we could go on this all day, but we're getting close to the end of the program. It's like time just rolls out of here so quickly. But I want to recap really quickly while we still have a moment that my guest today is Richard Miller. And Richard has written many books that are available on Amazon. The first that are concerning us in this particular moment was Drug Warriors and Their Prey, which he wrote in 1997, provides a really interesting snapshot of what's going on in America right now with the drug war. And what other, you've written several other titles, and I know we just don't have time to get into, because in a second here, Jeff is going to come up. He's going to be speaking in a phone interview with Mike Farrell, who is a spokesman for MADP. So we need to, we got like all of 2 minutes to wrap it up and say.
Well, I can mention too that I've also written.
His time. It's time for us to say thank you so much for coming in. We could get into this topic. Like I was saying, this is like, but Richard.
Well, it's been a pleasure visiting with you and your listeners. That's great.
We thank you so much for coming in and joining us here on KKFI. And Richard, I'm sorry that we could cover this topic for days and still not get the point. Is that we need you to come out and take a look at this film so you get an idea of what's going on with the drug war. And Richard, I'd like to thank you so much for coming in and joining us here at KKFI.
In the state of Illinois about 9 years ago, cold-blooded killer, he went against the law. He killed a factory guard when his robbery did fail, and they caught him and they threw him into jail. He lay there in his cell, locked up with his hate. Not many men knew of him and less cared for his fate. And he knew no peace of mind when his trial was coming by. The judge said, "You are guilty, you must die." But Paul Crump is alive today. He's a-sittin' in his cell. He's got something to say. Every man has got something to give. And if a man can change, then a man should live.
This is Jeff Humfeld, and you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. And on the phone with us now is Mike Farrell. Many of you will remember Mike as for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt on the TV series MASH. Mike, welcome to KKFI.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
First, I want to let folks know that you are on the phone, although you are here in Kansas City. You're rehearsing for the play On Golden Pond that will be at the New Theater, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
When do performances start?
The 23rd, we start some previews, and I think it's the 31st the show opens.
Well, good luck with the production. I hope that you have good performances.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
One of your other passions, besides acting, of course, is social activism, and in particular the death penalty. What brought you to this whole issue of the death penalty?
Well, many things. I've long been a believer that we shouldn't be in the business of killing people, but I was part of a halfway house organization in Los Angeles in the 60s, and I, with it, went into prisons to meet with mostly men, some women, who were coming out and trying to convince them that there was a program that was available to them that would give them some options in terms of their lives so they wouldn't have to go back to the mean streets and kind of just repeat what got them into trouble in the first place. And that educated me considerably to the failings of our criminal justice system, the problems people have that put them behind bars, and the ways in which they're treated behind bars, and that generally make them only worse rather than better in terms of their social actions. And when I was doing MASH later years, a minister from Nashville contacted me and said that, as I knew, the death penalty had been started up again in this country in 1976, and wanted to know if I would help him do some work to try to end it. And I got involved with him at the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons, and have been doing this work ever since.
Well, one of the things that you're going to do while you are here in Kansas City, besides be at the New Theater, is you're going to be speaking this Saturday at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 45th and Walnut, 4501. This is a benefit for the local chapter of the Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. What are you going to speak about there?
Well, what I like to do, you know, I can certainly talk about my experience with the death penalty and with the way in which it is failing our country, but I also want to hear from the people to whom I'm speaking and kind of answer whatever questions I can for them. So I'll talk a little bit about my experiences. We just recently come very close in California to passing an initiative to end the use of the death penalty. We missed by 2 percentage points, which surprised a lot of people that we got that much support. And I think next, by the time of the next election, if it's necessary still, then we can probably prevail, as has been the case in a number of states in recent years and will be probably this year again in different parts of the country, understanding that the death penalty really doesn't serve anybody. It's costing a hell of a lot of money that's unnecessary that could be used for better purposes. And when we have the option of life in prison without parole, for example, so we're wasting, I think, time, energy, and I would say our souls in maintaining a system that is racist at its core, is only used against the poor, is entrapping and killing innocent people, and serving no one in the process.
Yes, whenever we put someone to death, we create another family that's lost a loved one.
Indeed.
I think that's one of the things. This speaking engagement is at 7 p.m. this Saturday, January 19th, once again. And if anybody's interested in tickets, they will be available at the door. Prices and more information on a reception that's going to be before the speaking engagement, they can call Kathleen Holmes at 816-931-4177, and I believe that there will be copies of your book, Just Call Me Mike, available for purchase also.
I heard that. That'll be fun.
So, Mike, we want to thank you very much for coming on with us and talking even just briefly here. I hope that, you know, your performances are well attended and everything works out well for you here.
Thank you very
much. And we'll see you on Saturday.
Good.
And folks, I want to let you know that the music you heard before this interview was Phil Oakes performing his song, Paul Crump.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project, Inc., its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, www.kkfi.org. You can also join the Jaws of Justice Radio group. Email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Trishelle, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern weighs in on the nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA. Friday at 9 a.m. on Between the Lines, women are victims of violence and are stigmatized across the globe, and the FBI spies on the Occupy movement for U.S. banks. Up next is Counterspin, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Lucius Lin, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m.